Welcome to the Delling Pod with me, James Dellingpole. And I know I always say I'm excited about this week's special guest, but before we meet him, let's have a word from one of our sponsors. Sina Crisps. I used to eat loads and loads of crisps in my normie days, and then, of course, I discovered that they're all cooked in toxic seed oils, and so I pretty much gave up. The people behind Sina have come up with a brilliant idea of cooking crisps not in seed oils, but in coconut oil, so they're actually not harmful to you. And they also taste... good. Was that a good idea to eat my crisps in the middle of the advert? I'm not sure. Anyway, I just want to make something absolutely clear. Just because I'm starting to do crisp adverts doesn't mean I'm about to become the new Gary Lineker. That's a joke that will go completely over the head of non-British viewers, and I envy those who don't know who Gary Lineker is. They're organic, they are not ultra-processed food, no seed oils, and you can find them at www.sinacrisps, that's S for sugar, I-N-A, crisps.com.
Use the code James for 15% off your order.
So, again, I'm not Gary Lineker, and I envy those of you who don't know who Gary Lineker is. I'm advertising crisps, but they are good crisps. They taste good, and they're cooked in coconut oil. So check out Sina Crisps.
Use the code James, J-A-M-E-S, that's me, for 15% off your order.
Welcome to the Delling Pod, Aaron Smith. I am looking forward to this because I don't know what we're going to talk about, except I know you emailed me and you made a convincing case over a series of emails that, yeah, you'd be a great guest. So I'm hoping I know my hunch is going to be correct. You are going to be great. Tell me, where are you calling from? Where are you speaking from now?
I'm in Wisconsin in the United States. So, right, not too far from one of the Great Lakes, Great Michigan or Lake Michigan.
Isn't that Fargo, where Fargo is set?
Fargo is a bit west of us.
Yeah,
I would say they're about as far north as us, just west.
Is that the weird state where all sorts of strange judicial corruption happens?
It does happen in Wisconsin. I think you're thinking of Minnesota, which is...
Oh, am I? Oh, yeah. Okay. Is Minnesota the really dodgy one?
And Illinois to the south. So, but we have our fair share of dodginess here in Wisconsin.
Tell me just before we move on, what is Wisconsin known for? I mean, just if you wanted to sum it up from a kind of an awake person's perspective. Would we want to flee there, or is it hostile territory?
I think we're pretty good. I think we're pretty safe here, but there is a lot of, political corruption and all the other things that are going on. So far, we've kind of been dodging the data centers.
Have you? Well done.
We're getting sprayed like nobody's business though over here. And, where I live in Oshkosh, we have a university. So of course there's always, an influx and additional amount of propaganda, and they're all about all the things. So the Green New Deal kind of stuff. We were one of the first places in the country to start testing our wastewater, just sifting through our own feces to try and find COVID, things like that. So
the impression I get when I travel around the world and when I talk to people from different parts of the world is that we're all victims of the same conspiracy.
Yeah.
Some bits they push harder in some places, but they're spraying the clouds everywhere. They're introducing green eco-fascist nonsense everywhere.
We're a little behind the times. The coasts are really aggressive And we're in the middle of the country. So I think we get a little bit, you know, people are still running around wearing some of the fashions from the late 90s. I mean, we're a little behind. And
how embarrassing for you. And you
it's a beautiful place, though. And, you know, we get all four seasons. And so right now, you know, we're out in the garden. We're enjoying the weather. I'm sitting on the porch with my dogs and reading books and just being able to really enjoy life in a full sense, where when you don't suffer through the kind of winters that we have, you know, it kind of, the contrast with the beautiful weather really comes through for us.
I like that. It is good having distinguishable seasons. How are the mosquitoes in the summer?
They can be a bit vexing. But I haven't seen as many. So I don't know if Bill Gates or Google or whatever are releasing some of their sterile male mosquitoes around here or what.
What is that about? I mean, I went to a Medellin, as it's pronounced, in Colombia, where you can see all the narcos, the sort of the barrios type sort of Mad Max type city and stuff, and but now the main thing about Medellin, apart from the sort of Pablo Escobar museums and stuff, is that's where Bill Gates's mosquito breeding factory is. And you think, hang on a second, this is kind of megalomaniac behavior, releasing vast quantities of mosquitoes. And most people are like, yeah, well, it's just, you know, it's a reasonable method to control mosquito populations or something. I mean, whatever excuse is, they've bought it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very effective propaganda. And it's like Alul would refer to it, it's propaganda of integration. So it's very effective against the more educated and sophisticated classes, because it works horizontally and it's self-affirming through the class of experts that it's not like the agitation propaganda that's used to cause uprisings. It's more of a subtle.
Sorry, what's the name for this particular kind of propaganda?
Propaganda of integration.
Right. You've obviously studied this stuff.
Yes.
On some level. Where, how, where did you read all this stuff?
Honestly, it all started for me. I mean, I was always a skeptical person, but I was in nursing school, obviously a non-traditional student during the pandemic. And so what I saw, and it was so disturbing to me and so like disorienting to have a discordant, you know, like have a professor who was teaching me one thing one semester suddenly go back and flip 180 degrees and all of a sudden be telling me something completely contrary. And you could see that they were fully invested in this, and the cognitive dissonance when you would bring up the discordance would be it's a physical pain that you see that they're experiencing when you ask questions that contradict whatever narrative it is that they're pushing, and because they know but they can't know. It's that double think that Orwell talked about.
That's really interesting. Were you the only person on your course who perceived this cognitive dissonance in action?
I don't believe so, but I think I was one of the few people that actually spoke up about it. But you know, As I said, I was a non-traditional student, so I think a lot of the younger people didn't have the same confidence to ask. But I would be stopped outside of classrooms on multiple occasions, and people would say, "Hey, thanks for saying something about that, or thanks for asking that question. I feel the same way, but you know, I didn't want to say anything." And you know, I would just try and encourage them to say, "You know, this is a university. So we should be encouraged to ask questions. You should never be afraid to ask a question. And, you know, do it respectfully, do it with some charity, but, you know, ask the question. And they have the title, they have the position. They're supposed to be resilient enough to answer a simple question about the topic that they're purported to be experts in.
When you describe yourself as a non-traditional student, is that a particular designation, or is that just you describing yourself there?
It is a particular designation in that I was in my 40s and I was using my GI Bill to go back to school rather than, you know, graduating high school like a normal person and then going to college. So,
okay. So we should take a step back, shouldn't we? We should rewind to the beginning of your journey. Because I imagine there must have been a moment, as there was for most of us, where you suddenly went, hang on a second, the world just does not make sense. I mean, I imagine when you joined the military, you did so with enthusiasm and with a degree of belief in the system.
Yeah, for sure. And I've always been, you know, I was homeschooled for a while when I was younger. I never felt like I fit in. So I've always had kind of this alien feeling. And even when I joined the military, I did truly believe that I was doing something right and good. And I did it for the right reasons, as one would say. But in my time there, I realized what I was being told and what I saw and didn't really jive, and the systems that are used to indoctrinate are on such a grand scale in the military. And since I was 32 years old when I joined, so my whole life's been non-traditional, I would say.
Yes, that's quite late to join, isn't it? And
yeah,
which branch of the military did you join?
The Army Reserve.
Which meant what? Were you infantry?
So I was a combat medic in a combat support hospital at Cache. So it was like the one weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, which is a little bit misleading because it's much more than one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year once you actually do it. But I did train as a combat medic and then was able to go on various missions and do that. And then I later on in my career shifted to being a civil affairs operations sergeant. So that's a whole different thing. That's a little branch of special operations. You work closely with psychological operations. And so my interaction with the psychological operations really, really made me say, I think I want to get out. And so I went inactive and I went to nursing school. So,
okay. I want to touch on this. That psychological operation stuff sounds very interesting. But before we go there, so you actually served as a combat medic in the field?
Yes, but it sounds much more grandiose than it is. Essentially, I was working in an ER when I was overseas. I had training in combat medicine, and that was my designation, but nobody was shooting at me. I didn't, you know, I wasn't kicking down doors with the kung fu grip and all that. It was more of a hospital job.
Yeah, but if I'd been shot and I came to you, you'd presumably have the skills to be able to sort me out.
Yes. Yeah, I got the training for all that stuff. And, you know, I work as a nursing supervisor now and worked on the floor in a maximum security psychiatric treatment facility where we do have some pretty severe self-harm incidents and assaults and things like that. So,
right. I wanted to talk to you about that as well, about whether paranoid schizophrenics are actually subject to demonic attack. I don't know whether you've got views on that one, but we'll come back to that one later on.
Okay.
Tell me about the psychological. Actually, no, I'm worried. Look, I'm worried, Aaron. I think I may have been in my shoulder by a bullet of some kind. I don't think it's heavy caliber because my arm would have been torn off, wouldn't it, by now? What are you going to do? What's your first move?
We want to stop the bleeding. That's generally where we start.
Yeah. Please make it stop, Aaron. Make it stop. What are you going to do? What are you going to pack with one of those sort of those padded things they shove on?
Oh, well, that's a difficult place to go because you don't have a tourniquet for that. So you got to just do a lot like a pressure dressing.
Yeah.
You're going to probably want to assess for, pressure building up in your chest cavity too, if that's where it went to. So
might not have to do a needle chest decompression. I thought I'd chosen an easy wound. It sounds like I would.
No, it can get pretty complicated.
And presumably you're going to tell me, you're going to reassure me that I'm not going to die. It's all going to be okay, soldier.
I don't think that's ever a good idea. We're going to do the best we can for you, and we're going to get you the help you need. Hang in there.
That's what you say, right?
Yeah, I definitely don't want to promise someone they're not going to die.
Well, I think that's what I'm sorry, Aaron. That's what I want to hear right now. I want to hear that I'm not going to die and you're letting me down. Anyway, tell me about the PSYOP stuff. You were the wrong person for that job because you were being given an inside view of the enemy territory there, weren't you?
It felt that way, but at the time I was still relatively unscathed by the world in the sense that I believed a lot of what I was told. But then when I went to the training there and so they set up this whole village, like the way it all ends up when you finish certifying for this, you have to go through this entire field exercise and they take like connexes. And they build this entire village and then they pay actors to come in and play the people in the village. And so my job is in civil affairs would be to gather information and gain access and influence to the local politicians and the people of that have more influence and kind of guide them to whatever it is that we want to accomplish. And we kind of some bribery. Hey, why don't we build you a school and then give us access to these back roads here and your information about the logistics of your village and the politics of your village. Give us a little influence. So you're kind of bribing. And then psychological operations is coming in and they're using behavioral psychology techniques to influence the population so that they think positively of us. And so those two things kind of work together, and then we're passing all that information on to intelligence, and intelligence is taking that information and processing it into actionable intelligence, which is it's a product, so we get a lot of information just thrown at us in our day-to-day lives, and what we do is we have to compress that, triage it, turn it into actionable intelligence. And so we were the information gatherers, intelligence made into a product that was easy to hand off to, let's say, the psychological operations, and psychological operations could then use that intelligence to create a more effective psychological tool for propaganda.
Wow. So
it's a very complex system, and it's a technology, it's a tool, so it could be used for good, it could be used for bad. More often than not, though, considering who the warmongers are and what their actual goals are versus their stated goals, I would say more often than not, used for ill.
Yeah. So they're using a lot of resources to train people. The villages, what do they look like? They look like a normal U.S. village, or...?
No, they're a little janky, but they have they have the town hall, they have the little homes, and then they have the businesses and all that, but it's all made out of stacked and fabricated connexes.
And do the actors who play these villagers, do they come in in buses every day to play their role. So how does it work?
Well, they do a really good job. They're like crisis actors.
Yes. You know?
They really know what they're doing. And my favorite part about the whole experience actually was there was this guy from the East Coast, and he was like a used car salesman in his civilian life. And he was hilarious, and he would constantly be trying to make the actors break character. So he'd be like talking about how he thinks maybe the mayor and the drug lord are a little closer than they're letting on, and you know, just kind of making some little innuendo and messing around and getting the characters to break their, or the actors to break character. So.
Did he succeed?
He did, yeah. He was pretty a dynamic personality, so he was pretty good at it.
But okay, so you see, I think you're the first, or maybe the second person I've ever come across who has had serious engagement with crisis actors. So I think in the kind of the awake world, a lot of us think that crisis actors are like movie and TV actors, only a bit more shit. You know, that they couldn't get a job on the stage or even on TV, so they ended up essentially making political propaganda and pretending to get shot and pretending to get blown up by terrorism, and they keep cropping up again and again. But you're saying they're a bit more sophisticated than that.
I thought they did a really good job. A couple of them were not so good, but I don't know. I suppose it's very hard to get discovered in the world of acting. So maybe they're just waiting for their moment, and they're actually really good actors.
Yeah, maybe. Well, they probably get a lot of practice. I mean, the amount of work that crisis actors get these days, but perhaps it was ever thus, but they seem to be very in demand right now.
I was pretty skeptical of the whole idea at one point. And I do these things. Let me just do a quick search. And there was on the website Indeed. Are you familiar with it? It's like a job searching website.
Oh, yeah.
So there was actually just a posting for crisis actors on there. So looked like it was decent pay.
Tell me about the pay. Can you remember what it was?
I want to say it was like $2,000 a week.
Which, in this economic climate, is not
that's
bad.
That's pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good.
And in your village that you had to kind of work round to your way of thinking, but how many crisis actors were there?
There had to be somewhere between 40 and 60. I mean, it wasn't a whole village, but there was enough to give the appearance that this was an inhabited area.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, okay. So while this was going on, you were still thinking, this is legit. I'm kind of working for the good guys, more or less.
It was starting to get pretty creepy to me. As I was down there, I had to do that training down at Fort Knox, and I was already pretty disenfranchised. And the whole reason why I even did that change was because I thought I was going to get called up to go on active duty for a stateside deployment, essentially to be coordinating with like FEMA and doing pandemic preparedness stuff. And this is, mind you, this is 2019. So this is prior to, they were already activating units for pandemic preparedness prior to any COVID anything. And so one of the units I was in was getting ready. And I know people that they did about 3 years of active duty service. And I had just been away from my family for a year in Kuwait, and I didn't really want to be doing it anymore. And I thought if I switch jobs and go to this training, I won't have to go to this active duty in stateside. And I always kind of liked the idea of civil affairs because the way it's sold is like you're just giving soccer balls to poor kids in Ghana or something. You know what I mean? So,
whereas it's not, it's more CIA, isn't it?
It's definitely more, you give soccer balls to kids, but there's a, you want access and influence. You want,
yeah.
You just get the nice guy, you know?
Yeah, you're like the guys at the beginning of that scene in Apocalypse Now, where one of them is played by Harrison Ford, and they're giving Martin Sheen his mission. You probably don't even remember that film. You're probably too young.
I do. No, I'm not that young.
Cause it used to be one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. I used to watch it so much because I used to think it would have been really cool to have been in the NAM. You know, I thought, yeah, I would have loved those tiger pattern camouflage special forces and to, you know, to have taken out Charlie.
Like a snail pulling itself across the edge of a razor. That's a great line by Marlon Brando.
It is. I didn't identify with that bit. I identified much more with the boat when they're machine gunning the side of the river. or the Rise of the Valkyries, Charlie Don't Surf, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can see you must have been heavily vetted for this job. They must have thought you were psychologically suitable for this role.
Yeah, but I have no idea why, because if anybody that knows what my personal life history is and how I lived prior to coming to Christ, it was quite a harrowing experience. So it was pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, tell me.
I was a heavy alcoholic drug user. I mean, very out of control for a very long time. And so when I was 29 years old, I was kind of a quick snapshot testimony. When I was 29 years old, I woke up on a basement floor. I had no idea where I was. And I thought it was 6 o'clock in the morning. The next day, it was 6 o'clock at night, 3 days later. Hadn't been the first time I ever blacked out, but I knew it was that was the end. Like God was telling me, hey, it's now or never. So I said a simple prayer. Hey, God, I can't do it anymore. You win. So whatever you want for me, you open a door, I'll walk through it. Whatever you want in my life, I'm going to do what you want instead of what I want, because I know what I do with my life. I make a mess out of it. And so I devoted my life to Christ that day. And I've been blessed ever since in many, many ways. Hasn't been easy. You know, you got to fight for every inch either way. But God's always given me the strength and the grace that I need. So
to be fair, though, Aaron, a lot easier than being an alcoholic having 3 day blackouts. I mean, I've never had that problem. I've always been a kind of non-addictive, so I've taken lots of drugs, but I've never, you know, never become habit forming with me. So I do feel sorry for those who can't just taste and then move on. What were you doing apart from the booze?
Pretty much anything I could get my hands on. I really liked cocaine with whiskey. Those two together, yeah. A lot of psychedelics. Of course, smoking a lot of weed. I mean, of all the stuff, I think that's the least immediately damaging to your life, though. I don't think it's a good idea for anybody to do, but I don't put that in the same category as even alcohol because of the amount of destruction I've seen alcohol cause in lives.
I was going to say alcohol, because it's legal and because it's endorsed and almost advocated by every movie you see. It's kind of it's the key to a glamorous lifestyle. And you've got James Bond drinking his martini, shaken, not stirred. Everyone drinks. Everyone drinks coffee as well. But everyone drinks in the movies, and it's great. But alcohol, is it maybe the most damaging of all the drugs?
Well, I think what you say about it being so permissible, and Wisconsin is a notoriously heavy drinking state, so it's very culturally accepted and endorsed and almost praised. Even though nowadays, I think, like the younger generation, they're not really doing it the way we did.
Yeah, yeah, I've noticed this as well.
But they're addicted to something else, and that's much more effective for the powers that be than alcohol. So the technology, and you know, you watch people walking around. I don't even know, like, it's a testament to the beauty of God's creation with our minds and our bodies and how adaptable we are, that they can somehow have adapted to the proprioception that they're able to navigate through walking through a street or going into a store and shopping and not running into each other or getting run over by cars, and somehow simultaneously just watching their screen the whole time they're walking around. It's absolutely terrifying. And why I think people will readily accept any kind of augmented transhumanist proposal when it comes to starting with maybe smart glasses and then you know, neural implants, I think are going to be very easy to get through the public acceptance. I mean, one of the, so this book that I wrote, Project Nimrod, is sort of based on that transhumanist and technocratic trajectory that I see us in, and the technology that everybody has accepted, except for a few, is called integration technology. And I'm sure you've heard people use this word a lot as of late, integration with technology. It's kind of trending, you know, so to speak, because the idea of depersonalizing people, and I think this is what the trans thing is about. Now, I kind of go off on tangents, so you got to reel me in
I like tangents, Aaron. It's what I do as well. I can't. It's a vice, but I'm happy to indulge it.
Well, the even the trans movement, I think, is very much connected to the idea of disembodying humanity from their physical bodies in their psychology. So you can, if you can convince somebody that they are whoever they want to be in their head, regardless of what their body is, you can disenfranchise them from their physical existence and the real lived experience in the world, and impose on them this transhumanist digital proxy of life. And I think those things work hand in hand, and there are transhumanists that have openly said so.
That's really interesting. I haven't heard it expressed quite so clearly, that sentiment. That first of all, the reason that, what are they, Generation Z?
Yeah, like the Zoomers now. Yeah.
Zoomers. The reason that generation don't drink is because the powers that be no longer find it useful to mess with our brains with alcohol and have the social consequences, because they've moved on to the next phase of the operation. Because people would explain young not drinking alcohol, they'd say, well, it's because, have you seen the price of a pint of beer in a pub these days? It's increased exponentially. No, young people can't afford it. They won't even preload before they go to a pub these days. You know about preloading, where you drink lots of.
Yes.
But so it's presented to us as a kind of choice thing, But actually, it's a choice which has already been decided by the powers that be. They've steered Generation Z onto that next phase, which is advanced transhumanism.
I think so. And you know, of course, these things are very incremental. And so you have, I mean, my generation, Generation X, I think, are you Generation X
I'm
as
generation
well,
X,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So our generation was the first to really start being in our parenting style, being very much more risk averse. And then I see that even with like my kids' parenting styles, they are the millennials. They are so unbelievably risk averse. And so the Zoomers, I think, are just another iteration of that. But rather than being as kind of neurotic and nervous as the millennials were in a different sense, they're risk averse and they're just so programmed to accept the experts. That scientism, I think, is really come full circle, and now the idea, and then really that's what you need for technocracy, right? You need that full appeal to authority. You have to get rid of the recognition that that's a problem, a logical fallacy. Now the appeal to authority is it's ubiquitous. That is what people use as their justification for why certain things are done or why they believe what they believe. And I think that is culminating in what we see with the AI now. When we were younger, we would go to the library if we were interested about something, and we would find a book about it, and we would diversify what we were looking at as much as we could within the means we had. And then Google came out, right? And people would initially, I think, or because we're lazy, people are lazy, we would like to just go to the top, whatever the Google result was, the top result.
Yeah.
Well, that's the truth. And now with AI, you don't even have pages of Google results to go through. You have one answer. That's the answer. And so it's fully culminated into this appeal to authority is no longer even recognized as a logical fallacy. It just is what you use to find truth in the world for many, many, many people.
You're frightening me now, Aaron, because actually you're explaining something which seems so obvious. Now you state it so boldly. I think you're right. These incremental changes, and unless somebody points them out, you don't notice them. But that generational shift, I think I'm uncharacteristic of my generation in that, I suppose, because I'm only 2 years, I think, away from being a boomer. 65, I think, is 63, I think, is the boomer cutoff, something like that. And I brought up my children like my parents brought up me. I was very, whatever the opposite of risk averse is, I would always be encouraging them to. So there was one occasion where we went to the local park, and it was the middle of winter, and the lake had frozen over, and there were all these signs saying "Do not cross this bridge" and "Do not go onto the lake." So obviously, as soon as I saw the sign, I instantly stepped over the tape on the bridge and took the children over, and then took them on to the lake so that we could skid around on the. And passers by they came and told me off. And I was thinking, well, who are you to be like telling me how to bring up my kids? This is what we do.
I think my family as well was what I recognize in other families. We didn't necessarily employ in our own. My brother's a great example, and by the way, he's a huge fan as well. And he wanted me to tell you how much he enjoys. Every single time you and Dick sit down together, So I was intrigued to please tell you that.
What's your brother called? I'll give him a shout.
David. David. Yes.
Shout out to David Smith. Yeah. Well, you may have guessed, Aaron, that even though I don't have favorites, all the episodes with Dick are the best. Because obviously, because we've known each other for, well, 59, getting up 58 years. And so we've acquired a certain rapport.
Yeah. I also really like, I have to say, I like when Tanya comes on, Edwards.
Tanya is the female Dick, but Tanya is super, 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 super clever. It's kind
she
of
is.
Frightening sometimes.
It almost reminds me when she comes on. The thing that popped in my head was I'm watching a butterfly tease a bumblebee.
Yeah. And I'm not that slow, am I? But yeah.
No, don't read too far into the bumblebee. It's just what popped into my head.
Bumblebees
are amazing in that they.
I mean, she's cleverer than a woman should be, I think, Aaron. I don't think it's natural. I really don't, actually. I don't think it's natural for a woman to be that clever. And she is. And it's great. Yeah, I love those episodes as well. I like the ones where you can just talk about. Where you genuinely don't know what you're going to talk about. I mean, in a way, this is a bit like that, because I although you'd sketched out some of the stuff you do, I wasn't sure where it was going to go, and I wanted the conversation to take its course. But the thing I get talking to you, I mean, we'd never spoken before, is that you're a deep thinker, and you've got a lot of really interesting insights into what's happening, I suppose, as a result of your psychological training background, maybe, and your work with, well, not just in the military, but within the sort of insane asylums and stuff.
Well, I think just being curious. And always, I've always been encouraged in my curiosity in my family, and so I think that has really helped. But yes, of course, then having been exposed to certain things and like working in the psychiatric treatment facility, certainly opens your eyes to things. The question you had earlier, maybe I'll bounce back to that about There are people who, and M. Scott Peck, I don't know if you've ever read any M. Scott Peck,
Roadless Travel. Everyone says I should read People of the Lie.
And People of the Lie, yeah. And People of the Lie, he talks about how it's very, very rare, but he has run into cases that he sincerely believes are cases of demonic possession. And so I am highly suspicious of mental health in general, the whole paradigm, even though I work in it. Have you heard of Thomas Szasz? He wrote The Myth of Mental Illness.
Heard of him.
And very, very much an interesting perspective about how that paradigm might be completely a fallacy in and of itself. But I can say that there are people that we have that, let's say, are acutely psychotic, and they are, you administer antipsychotic medication, and someone who is, you know, maybe like trying to pull their own eye out or eating their feces or something that totally outside of the norm, will all of a sudden be having a normal conversation with you within a month or so of taking this medication. And so
bear with us. It's got to be done. Another book plug from James.
Global warming is a massive con. There is no evidence whatsoever that man-made climate change is a problem, that it's going to kill us, that we need to amend our lifestyle in order to deal with it. It's a non-existent problem. But how do you explain this stuff to your normie friends? Well, I've just brought out the revised edition, my 2012 classic book, Watermelons. which captures the story of how some really nasty people decided to invent the global warming scare in order to fleece you, to take away your freedoms, to take away your land. It's a shocking story. I wrote it, as I say, in 2011, actually, the first edition came out. And it's a snapshot of a particular era, the era when the people behind the climate change scam got caught red-handed, tinkering with the data, torturing till it screamed, in a scandal that I helped christen ClimateGate. So I give you the background to the skullduggery that went on in these seats of learning where these supposed experts were informing us, we've got to act now. I rumbled their scam. I then asked the question, okay, if it is a scam, who's doing this and why? It's a good story. I've kept the original book pretty much as is, but I've written two new chapters, one at the beginning and one at the end, explaining how it's even worse than we thought. I think it still stands up. I think it's a good read. Obviously I'm biased, but I'd recommend it. You can buy it from jamesdellingpole.co.uk/shop. You'll probably find that one. Just go to my website and look for it, jamesdellingpole.co.uk. And I hope it helps keep you informed and gives you the material you need to bring round all those people who are still persuaded that, oh, it's a disaster, we must amend our ways and appease the gods, appease Mother Gaia. No, we don't. It's a scam.
Now, back to the Delling Pod.
Totally outside of the norm. We'll all of a sudden be having a normal conversation with you within a month or so of taking this medication. And so, as clever as the devil is, I don't know if the demons are like, oh, let's just take it easy after this medication's been administered and let them think that. But I think, you know, Occam's razor would say that the medication's working. But I will say that there are cases where there is absolutely nothing under the sun that touches the psychosis. And then those are the ones that I am most suspicious of. And I'll be like, I'll honestly be doing rounds and I will be praying to myself oftentimes. And I will say like the Lord's Prayer, you know, quietly, and I'll be watching for a reaction because
yeah,
I'm trying to poke the bear a little bit and see what's waiting.
Yeah. There. You look all sort of pink and I look all, my light. Problem is.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I just am gray and drawn at the moment. What a great test ground for your faith. I mean, walking among the demonically possessed.
I mean, when I go into work every day, there are a few verses that I try and recite to myself as well as the Lord's Prayer because I know that I'm going into the battleground, and whether or not people are demonically possessed, they are certainly oppressed. And there is certainly a heaviness, a spiritual heaviness within the institution because, you know, I'm dealing with the most acutely mentally ill people who are incarcerated in the state of Wisconsin are sent to us. So we have, you know, multi-murderers, we have rapists, we have pedophiles, we have all what people would consider would be, you know, the most undesirable people in the population do come to us for psychiatric treatment while they're incarcerated. So
what's your job? What do you have to do?
Well, I work as a nursing supervisor, and then I have a hybrid role. I also manage a security team and a unit. So I have like a psychologist and a social worker and a couple security supervisors and all the line staff. So
So you run the team.
I'm responsible, yeah, for them in a supervisory role. I don't even like the word manager because that I hate micromanagement. I think people are best left with the fullest amount of autonomy as possible in order for them to flourish and be have an internal locus of control and feel like they're personally invested in whatever they're doing. So I try and think of myself as a support person. And if something goes sideways, I'm the one that takes the hit. You know, kind of the buck stops with me.
Yeah, but I'm really encouraged that somebody like you has such responsibilities within the system. Because, I mean, that's good. That's good for everyone. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's good for your poor patients. That you're...
Yeah, I have a lot of compassion for them because you see this generational cycles playing out. And I know what one of my favorite things that I refer to and why my kind of handle is Subtle Cain is I think of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's line from the Gulag Archipelago, the line between good and evil runs through the heart of every person or cuts through the heart of every person. And so recognizing that I have the full potential and with my history, understanding that I am capable of some very terrible things and that I'm no better than anyone else. I think of Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things. Who can understand it? And you think about how we all have the same potential to do these horrendous things. And by the grace of God go I, and I have not either done things or, let's be honest, been caught doing things.
Yeah.
So I try very hard, and sometimes it is very hard, to always see them as God sees them, and that's as children. Not in a, you know, patriarchal sense myself, but as God's children, and that they are loved by Him, and grace is sufficient. So no matter what they've done or what condition they're in, God still loves them and can redeem them. So I try to see that, even though it can be very hard with some of the people.
Yeah, when you hear what they've done, I imagine that must be quite tricky.
It can be. Yeah, I actually try not to know why they're there and just focus on what we're doing while they're there.
And you've obviously got to have a protection team because some of these people could be quite violent, I imagine, if you're not careful.
Oh yeah. We have a very solid security team and they're very professional. I call them the hard charging Randys. Like if you got to hit the button and it's time, they will come with a quickness and they will take care of what needs to happen. But what I've been most impressed with is the compassion that they're able to show and the professionalism that they're able to show. You know, you think about like a maximum security prison setting and, you know, you kind of get the movie interpretation would be like, you know, they're coming with billy clubs and they're just whacking people down. And
yeah,
you know, it isn't like that at all. They do everything they can to kind of decompress the situation, de-escalate. But there are times you have to go hands on, and in those times they're so professional and so strict about what they do and don't do and how it's done, and that it's all videotaped and that they're all I've been extremely impressed and humbled by the amount of restraint I've seen versus the amount of force I've seen.
You've presumably listened to the Jerry Marzinski podcast. You've heard of him.
I have not, no.
Oh.
Jerry Marzinski.
Aaron, you are in for such a treat. So Jerry Marzinski, very briefly, because I don't want to spoil, waste the time of people who listen to all these podcasts. He's a psychiatrist, or is known. He does a similar job to yours, and he's based in Arizona, and he's had tremendous success treating the kind of, is it schizoid or paranoid schizophrenia, where people hear the voices in their heads.
Yeah.
And he's worked in several maximum security facilities with people who could not possibly have communicated with one another because they're geographically separated or whatever. And he's found a remarkable consistency with what the voices in their heads are saying. And he's had great success with the 23rd Psalm. He says that these voices really, I mean, here's a tip for you. Yeah. 23rd Psalm, they don't like it.
I would imagine.
Yeah. And it's nice and short. And I mean, there are other tricks. I think possibly if they were Muslim prisoners, they might require a different text, maybe. But yeah.
Okay.
The scripture, they don't like scripture, these these creatures.
No, I would imagine not. I would imagine not. And it is an integral part of my day that I need to pray and meditate on scripture, because it can be so dark. And sometimes I do get really down, and I have to ask for strength. It's not something I would have put myself in, and I don't know why God has me there. I don't know why God has me in medicine, because I absolutely abhor the medical system, and I don't necessarily care for the criminal justice system, and I'm really suspicious of psychiatric care. And so all of it together, just I know God put me here because too many things happened that are unlikely to happen.
What do you mean by that? What you mean? You mean just simply that combination of your dislikes and where you've ended up, or something? Do you have more of a story to tell there?
Well, the favor that God's shown me in life ever since I surrendered my life to Him, it's just mind-boggling. And opportunities. The prayer is always and has been since I was 29. So 20 years now has been, if you open a door, I'll walk through it. And so I pray before I make a big decision. And the only reason why I ended up in this place was because nobody else would take me for my last semester of clinicals, because I refused to get the jab. And so nobody would take me. But this place said, just sign a waiver saying that you don't want it. And so it was the only place I could finish my nursing degree with. And I was willing to give up 4 years of college and my pursuit of nursing. I was not taking this thing. And I know people did. So I don't judge. But God put that line in my heart to say, you will not cross this line. And so it cost me heavily, and it almost cost me my entire career. But God put me in this place. And I see it that way. And then I only worked there for several years, and now I'm in the position that I'm in, which is a very unlikely situation too. And I just am very grateful for Him, but I don't understand the why.
So, sorry, are you saying that the only job available to you was in this sort of prison psychiatric system because you wouldn't take the jab?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, nobody else would give me even a clinical site for my clinicals. I wouldn't have been able to become an RN. And I was willing to do that.
So in order to complete your qualifications, to gain your qualification, you had to do practical work. And the only place that would give you the practical was the prison system. Of course it was.
Yeah, they were sign this piece of paper saying you don't want it, and you can come on in. And they were very good to me and hired me before I graduated. And they have been good to me. But I don't trust the system. But the people I work with, I think God maybe helped me see that some of these systems and some of these, even with the government and stuff, that not everybody is the spirit behind what they're doing. And so they might be deceived. They might be being used by the enemy, but they are not themselves personally invested in, like, you know, maniacal, trying to like bring down the society. They're very much involved and integrated into that thinking. So they're, you know, with propagandists, are the most susceptible people to propaganda, including their own propaganda.
And is that right?
It is. And that's well documented in Jacques Ellul's work, propaganda, also in Edward Bernays' own book, Propaganda. He kind of alludes to that. I'm trying to think here. Matthias Desmet, you're familiar with him?
Yes.
Actually was wondering about him the other day, because I never hear anything. You know, it's kind of like, I get a little suspicious all the time when someone just blows up and then they disappear.
I know what you mean. Get that? There were a few of those. These names that appeared, and when they were presented to you as, these are the guys you should trust, they're really important. And then they disappeared. And you kind of think, well, have they served their function? Were they working for the enemy? Or I don't have a view on Matthias Desmet, but yeah.
I don't either, except for I read his book, Psychology of Totalitarianism, and I found it to be amazing. I thought it was a really good book. And so maybe that was just a flash in the pan gestalt kind of a thing.
Did Ellul or anyone explain why propagandists are so susceptible to propaganda?
If I could try to think back and summarize quickly, I think it's because of the fact that they are so self-assured, and so in their pride, in their egotism, they are brought into these echo chambers, and in order to justify what they're doing, they need to lie to themselves as well. And so it just is like a positive feedback loop.
You would need that, I think. You would need to persuade yourself that what you were doing was okay.
And I have to ask myself on a regular basis, and I have to ask God all the time, please show me the line. If there's a time in my professional career and there's a line that I am not supposed to cross, I need to know. Show it to me, make it really clear. And at that time, I will make that decision then. I will not cross the line once you show it to me. And that's kind of been one of my prayers as well, always, since I came to Christ and found sobriety through that. Because, you know, with addiction, it's the lies. I mean, yeah, you're using the drugs, it's bad for you, you're harmful to people, but it's a life of deception. Yourself, others, you just live in a lie all the time. And that's the most difficult part of it. It isn't the hangovers. It isn't the relationship problems. It is the fact that you are constantly living in a lie. You have to justify yourself, and that's what I see around me in the society in general now.
Yes. Yeah. I was just thinking of a line from one of the Psalms. I've chosen the way of truth. It's from Psalm 119. It's much easier, isn't it? I mean, when you make the truth your watchword. Lying is really complicated,
and it's painful, and it's self-perpetuating, you know. The truth is very painful, but only like ripping off a band-aid, you know, whereas a lie is a chronic illness. I would rather just get the slap in the face from the truth, than have a bulbous, gangrenous kind of tumor of deception living in me.
So, when you are in, you mentioned that every day you go in to pray, you say prayers before. Have you ever had any kind of physical reaction from your? I mean, I suppose I'm bringing the Jerry Marzinski knowledge that I have to the party here. But does this ring a bell when you say your passages of scripture? Do the prisoners go mad or madder?
I can't say I've had that experience. But I do watch for it, and I'm suspicious that I will at some point run into that. But I can't say honestly that I have noticed anything like really glaringly obvious, or they jump up on the wall and skitter around or something. Nothing that exciting.
Have you found any fellow awake people within the system?
I have. Yeah, and it's kind of funny because you almost feel like you're in let's say like Soviet Union and you're maybe like passing a cigarette and inside you have a little message written, when they pull the paper of the cigarette apart. It's very covert and it isn't like you're ashamed of it, but you're just like it's not necessarily safe. And I always joke around with my wife and say, at some point, because I don't really have much of an online presence, but I said at some point, Aaron Smith's alter ego, Subtle Kane, is going to come out at work. And then we're probably going to have to think about what we're doing with our finances until I find another job.
I hope I'm not killing your job and your livelihood and your hair.
Oh no, I never hide.
Oh, okay,
but I'm very particular about what I share at work in the sense of just trying to be wise and judicious. And so, I mean, everybody at work knows that I wrote the book I wrote. They know that I talk about technocracy and things like that. They know that I'm a Christian. It's just, I think you can excuse a certain amount of dissidence, but at some point, I think the full extent of my disdain for the system is going to, I don't think I get fired, but I think it would definitely change. There would be a sea change in my perception from people at work.
Well, presumably, if it happens, given that God sounds, you've said to God, "I'm in your hands."
Yeah.
If you do get booted out, then it's probably part of His plan.
Yeah, I'll be grateful.
Yeah, but I'm guessing that God actually quite likes. I mean, I don't want to speak for God here, obviously, but just knowing He's got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And He likes confounding the enemy. So His sense of humor is putting you in this ridiculous job that you never in a million years should be in. I mean, in many ways. And He's confounding the enemy. He's put you in the system, the enemy camp. You're working for the man in a way.
Yeah. I am. Yeah. It's in the world, not of the world. And, you know, like I said, I'm grateful, and I think God is going to use my experiences that I'm having now to help me further share my testimony and allow me to more articulately discuss what we face as a society, especially with the beast system and the technocracy. Which I think is the face that the beast system is going to, it's more of like a techno-gnostic monster than just straight technocracy. It's not materialist. Yeah. It's very Gnostic.
It is. isn't it? And Gnosticism seems to be the elite's preferred route to God. I mean, okay, well, you've got the pure Luciferian devil worshippers, and I'm not sure how one can distinguish necessarily, because they all seem to have elements of one another. But Gnosticism, from what little I know about it, strikes me as it's very much an elitist philosophy. It's like we chosen have a special route to God, which is for adepts only, and
right,
the masses can go screw themselves because they're too dumb to get this crazy stuff that we've discovered that gives us a special inside. Mm-hmm. Do you agree? That's the
yeah, I do agree, and I think I tried to, you know, not I'm not trying to be ham-fisted about the book, but there's aspects about the storyline in Project Nimrod where there is a spiritual element underpinning the technocratic regime that Viveka that runs the world in that fictional. What I like about it is I'm able to use a fictional narrative to sort of pressure test and catastrophize and extrapolate on the things I'm seeing now in a way that I think is more accessible to people who don't want to talk about things straightforwardly. I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, that's really creepy because it reminds me of this thing that I saw. And that was kind of one of the goals. Is there's a quote, and then I'm not sure where the origin is, but it's a nonfiction writers use the truth to tell lies, and fiction writers use lies to tell the truth. And that always struck me as I can make up this fictional world, and I can talk about all these hypotheticals, but I can also utilize that as a vehicle to open people's minds to the possibility that the things that they're seeing could be extrapolated to the dystopia that I'm presenting. And maybe not, it's not meant to be prophetic. It's meant to, though, at least allow people that freedom and that safety of doing it in a controlled and fiction environment. So it's not so confrontational as, hey, guess what? There's Satanists that want to kill you. And not many people respond well to that, even though that's the truth. And so both things need to happen. We need people just calling it what it is. And then we also need, I think, more approachable and subtle ways through art and in comedy and fiction writing in order to present some of these ideas and these concepts in ways that are less physically painful, like that cognitive dissonance we talked about, how you can just see it on their face. You bring something up that doesn't jive and it's painful for them, but they can sit down and they can read a story about something fictional, but that's still making them think, oh, all that Elon Musk is actually trying to do that right now, or oh, Bill Gates was just talking about that, or, you know.
I can see that I'm going to have to read this book. You wrote to me and said, can I send you my book? And I said, look, Aaron, you don't understand. I read in bed, the Bible, the Book of Psalms, and another translation of the Bible. And my wife saying to me, are you going to read something else? Have you not finished it yet? And I say, well, I find it, I like reading it again. And she said, oh, right, okay. And then in the day I read my Russian grammar, even though I'm progressing painfully slowly. So I don't have time
it's
to read.
It's hard.
Much. Yeah.
Russian's very hard.
It's really hard. It's just impossible.
Yeah, I mean, the pronunciation. Много понимаю по-русски.
Yeah. Well, you see, I mean, I can't even string a sentence together like that.
That's just one that I memorized. So it's like a parlor trick. I understand a little Russian, and I could say that to someone, and then they'd be like, oh, and they would talk to me in Russian, and I'd be like, no, that's it for me.
I used to be able to say, the hedgehog lives in the park or lives near the park. Yosh jivyot v parkye. Yosh jivyot v parkye. Yeah, they've got things like the letter V, which you've got to work out so it aligns with the next word. So you can't say yosh jivyot v parkye, because they think, well, what's he saying? You've got to make the parkye. And there are different kinds of verbs of motion. There are different kinds. I love it. I mean, I think it's
I really... love it though. Yeah, I think Russian's awesome, and I'm a big fan of Tolstoy, Dostoevsky.
Yeah, I really who's like... your favorite out of those two?
I would say A Confession by Tolstoy, I think, is one of the most brutally honest apologetics pieces. I really like that book. I do like Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, though. That Raskolnikov is just such a... I understand, like, the physical illness that he gets from his guilt, and that it's really just such a vivid experience that you go through with him. Huh?
You've been Raskolnikov. I mean, I don't think you probably haven't killed an old woman to get her.
Thankfully
that's
not.
Something you're not telling me.
No, but I definitely know what that feels like, to just be completely and utterly eaten up with the self-loathing and the way your deceptive life, it just compounds on itself, and you literally become ill. And that's what I think we're seeing a lot of when we see, oh, there's this huge rise in mental illness. Well, I think part of that is that all of these lies that have been told to people, God always... He always plants a seed of truth in people, and when, you know, like Paul says, there'll be no excuse, because God's apparent in his creation. I mean, that's paraphrasing poorly, but I think people know to some extent that they're believing and living lies, and because of that, it causes them illness and discomfort and an inability to cope. And I think that's the real pandemic, is an inability to face reality because of these aggressive propaganda campaigns that we're generationally exposed to.
Yeah. Do you think it's been getting worse over generations? I mean, do you feel that society is more sort of morally... I mean, this is continuing a conversation I had on my last podcast.
Yeah.
Do you think we're getting more... We have less moral courage than we used to? Do you think people are... Or do you think it's always been like this?
Well, that I don't know. I know that the ability to fight back or to be resilient in the face of the just the volume and the intensity of the messaging. Like I said, when you're standing there staring at your phone all day, there was never the kind of access to people's minds like there is now. And so I think about, even this is one thing, I don't know what you think about this thought, but it's been bugging me. You know, computers written in binary code, ones and zeros, ones and zeros, ones and zeros, and the algorithms operate under that. And And you have the large language models, and that's what they use. And they use the math of linguistics in order to predict what words to use, right? But that binary code, I'm looking around at the people that I interact with, and there's such a polarization, and it's such a binary, it's so binary in nature. And I don't think that's insignificant, but I can't quite put my thumb on it. But I think the fact that the algorithms being written in binary code and the way that the machine thinks is manifesting in people being driven into these binary mindsets, good and evil, good and evil, good and evil. No room for any gray, no room for the human experience that's so nuanced and beautiful and flowing and fluid. It's just ones and zeros. This person, I have to shut them out of my life because they're a one and I'm a zero, or they're a zero and I'm a one. And it's very binary thinking. And I see that, I think, accelerating, and I think intentionally imposed with things like the left-right paradigm or the COVID vax, don't vax, all these different things. They're set up in binary terms. It isn't a nuanced relationship that people have with each other.
That's interesting. And you just made me think, although there's probably no connection at all, I don't understand about science, really. But do you remember when CDs came in? And record aficionados complained that the soft quality of analog on vinyl was being replaced by this horrible sound digital that set you on edge slightly, that CDs digital would never had the warmth of analog.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they use the same binary thing or not, but I think isn't what you're talking about really. We know that ultimately what the enemy wants to do is to replace God. Yeah. And they say that the devil cannot create, but he can imitate. And what's going on is this sort of simulacrum of God's creation, but it's a cheap knockoff version of God's. It's a sort of Chinese made in some sort of mass-produced factory, whereas God's stuff is all bespoke and handmade and enduring,
yeah,
and crafted.
The synthetic nature of just the life that we live in. I mean, to the point of now, you know, printed meat and these just abominations in the sight of God. The synthetic life that we live. And even when you're trying your hardest, you're still stuck with so much of it. I think the thought process too. There's another thing. Sorry to that. I'm so all over the place. But you said you don't mind, so
don't
I'm going to throw another one out there.
Don't apologize.
Well, Ouija boards. Everybody's kind of understood that Ouija boards are a bad thing, even if they're not like Christians or whatever, even if they're kind of like naughty kids playing around. There's something kind of scary about Ouija boards and just culturally understood that there's a risk involved. And I think what that risk is, most pertinently, is a surrender of your will to the spirits. And we're surrendering our willpower so often in so many cases, and God's given us this wonderful gift of will, and Satan's been asking for it since the garden, and he wants us to hand over our will towards him. And I was thinking about these search engines, and I was thinking about the large language models, and I was thinking about AI chatbots, and I thought, well, isn't that just a digital Ouija board? I'm not saying that there's a demon behind every chatbot saying, ha, 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 but I think there's something to that.
Aaron, there totally is. Somewhere on the internet, an Orthodox monk, bishop, priest, whatever, I'm not sure what he was, in Russia, talked about this.
Ah.
He did, yeah, exactly what you're saying. He gave this long, he was thinking, yeah, it was edited, but it was obviously quite well considered, and he reached exactly the conclusion that you've reached.
Ah. More articulately, I'm sure.
Well, more articulately in Russian. Then you could, you've just expressed the English version.
Sure.
I like, by the way, I you're a very good advert for Christianity, in that I think that in the days when I wasn't a proper Christian, I used to get freaked out by Americans particularly who'd found Jesus, and they can come on quite strong, but you talk about it in a kind of matter of fact way without making it look kind of freaky. You just make it look natural, which is good.
It is natural for me. I think I know what you're saying and how people can kind of, one of the things that I dislike or I distrust is when people share the gospel with the idea like, hey, just tell Jesus that you want him to be your savior and everything's going to be great, and you know, you're not going to have any more. And it's like, that's not actually how it works. You know, like, I surrendered my life to Christ 20 years ago and I'm still hammering out like some really stupid strongholds and you know, like behaviors and thought patterns, and just God's brought me a long way, but I am just a hot mess, and I know that I need God's grace every day, his mercy and his grace, because I'm not a good person. Left to my own, I'm not a good person, and but the good thing is, and what people often misunderstand about Christianity, is that that's not the goal. The goal is surrendering your will to the Father's will, and to say, I know that I'll never be enough. I'm going to try to follow your will as best as I can. I'm going to read your scriptures. I'm going to try and follow the path that you set out before me through the life and the incarnation of Jesus Christ. But I am never going to get there, but I'm going to keep on falling at the foot of the cross because I need that. And it isn't like other religions. It isn't like other ideologies. It isn't a system of rules for you to follow so that you can somehow cross the finish line. The work's already been done. And that's what I wish people would understand that. I wish they would internalize that. You don't become a Christian and then all of a sudden you're perfect. God works through you through his Holy Spirit. And he really just walks you through and with grace. And every time you surrender, no matter how many times you fall down, he picks you back up. And it's not this rigid condemnation and system of rules that you have to follow. Now, your life is going to be a lot better if you live the way Jesus told us to live. If, you know, obviously, the wisdom of the Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and all the ancient scripture, it's going to help you, but that's not the goal, isn't to follow the system. It's like putting new wine into old wineskins. They're going to burst. The rigidity of the system cannot hold the power of the gospel. And that's what the new wine into old wineskins is about.
Did you meet your wife after you became Christian, or before?
Shortly after.
I was gonna say,
what happened was, I prayed that prayer, right, about just walking through whatever door. I went to a short intensive inpatient treatment facility, and I got an email. I was taking some philosophy courses at the community college. For whatever reason, I don't know how I was even managing that at the time, but I got an email like, hey, we got this service learning trip out to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the Badlands for 10 days or a week. And it's only $100 and it's dry. So there's no drugs or alcohol allowed. So I went on this trip, right? And my wife happened to be on the trip as a future educator of America, of which I wasn't either. But God opened this door for me. So I went. And she was going through a pretty rough time in her life as well, not in the same fashion as me, but in a very difficult situation. And we met. And then God gave me the pleasure of being able to stay out there for 6 months and spend a lot of time in the Badlands by myself and just working like an animal, like 96 hours a week for room and board and like $1,200 a month. And I got to know my wife really well over a distance. You know, it's about 12-hour drive. And then after that 6 month period, I realized this is the woman. Actually, like after 3 days, I realized this is the woman I'm going to marry. But it took me about 6 months to get her there where she realized that we were meant to be together like that. So I moved back home and we've been together since.
And you've got children.
I have three stepchildren.
Yes.
So I consider them my, you know, I just call them
but one does.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's a great privilege to take on, you know, that responsibility and to be blessed with that chance to make a difference in the life of a child.
And because of various reasons, I was too afraid to bring another me into the world. And so when God finally healed my heart enough to know that that wouldn't have been necessarily the catastrophe I thought it was, it was a little bit too late to
right
long in the
do you think you've got bad blood in your
well, I believed that we have a lot of tragedy in my family's history, and then I also endured some pretty severe abuse as a child, not from my parents, but from somebody that we knew, and that changed the trajectory of my life and kind of was the pivotal moment that sent me flying off the rails into drugs and alcohol and all that. So,
gosh, that's jolly unfair.
Well, it is, but God's used it. But I can say that it definitely impacted many years of my life in ways that were extremely painful and upsetting. But at the same time, it's eternity that's really what's important. And so any temporal discomfort or suffering that we experience when contrasted with the eternity in glory is it's not even a blink of an eye. It's nothing. But I have endured some things that I wish I hadn't while I'm in this mortal coil, but God's used it all for his good.
Yeah. Well, that's very much the impression I've been getting. It's very good to talk to you. I really do feel that people ought to get the chance to read your book. So just do some hard sell. Are you happy with it? Is it got a good story as well?
Well, I believe so. Yeah, the book's called Project Nimrod. It's book one in the series. I'm writing book two right now. It's called The Viveka Chronicles. It came to me kind of in a flash, the general premise of the technocracy. That there is a protagonist that is living in this technocratic empire, and in the process he is one of the few who have chosen to be non-integrated. So he's rejected the integration technology and pays dearly for it. And so Project Nimrod is actually an acronym, but I do pepper a lot of little Easter eggs when it comes to, let's say, some Enochian, like Book of Enoch or Old Testament. So Nimrod, even though it's an acronym, there is some reference, I suppose, to the biblical story and some metaphor. But it's also, it's a pressure testing and an extrapolation of the things that we're seeing now. And it's like where institutions reward compliance instead of wisdom, and a conscience actually becomes an obstacle to efficiency. And so the way that our moral responsibility is offloaded to a system of experts. And that all sounds kind of boring when I say it like that. But the thing is I think I did a really good job, just to pat myself on the back a little bit for being a first-time author, of making the protagonist very lifelike. And the experience that he has, I try to keep it very honest with what would actually be experienced. And in the way that system, it does offer you a lot of perks. And there is a very good temptation, or a very strong temptation, to give in to the digital IDs and the vax mania and the implanted technologies, or whatever next horror they come up with. There are always things that make that very beneficial.
Yeah, when I first read Brave New World, I was like, yeah, give me some of that. I'm going to be an alpha. It's going to be great.
Yeah. And the struggle, and like I said, the underlying theme isn't just that the system's bad, but that we all have the tendency to do the wrong thing. And even in the beginning of the book, I use that Alexander Solzhenitsyn quote, "The line between good and evil cuts through the heart of every single person." I so much appreciate, James, the fact that you allowed me. I know I was kind of all over the place, and I love the fact that you just roll with things. And I came on here with no expectations, except for I was very excited to talk to someone that I respect very much, and I really enjoy your show, and your brutal honesty is just I think it's
honesty.
Well, Dick even talks about it, like your pathological inability to tell a lie, and I don't think people give you enough credit for how important that is for a listener like myself, who has such a strong passion for defeating even self-deceit. And the way that you talk about yourself and your own experiences, and the fact that you don't pull punches even on yourself. And I really appreciate that about you. So I was very proud to be able to come on today and talk to you.
Aaron, that's really nice of you to say so. Thank you. I appreciate that. So if people want to get a hold of your book, where do they?
Right now, I have it just for sale, print on demand. I self-published, so I own the publication rights, but the only place I can sell it right now that's not local is on Amazon. So there is you just look for Project Nimrod by Aaron J. Smith on Amazon, and they will print on demand and send it to you. I am working on setting up a website and getting some copies just printed, and so I can do that maybe without putting so much in the pocket of Jeff Bezos, but it's what I have.
He needs all the help he can get, Aaron. He's those weddings in Venice don't pay for themselves.
I also have articles that I publish on Substack, and so and the link to my book is on my Substack as well. And it's Subtle Cain, is my handle over there. And I do have a podcast that I did for several years. And give or take, depending on how far back in the beginning of it goes, you know, it's not as painful as you get later on in the podcast. But I do a lot of monologues, and I've also spoken to a lot of people on that podcast, and that's available all in archived and on Substack as well. So
Aaron, it's an occupational hazard of what we do that if you went far enough back on my podcast, you'd find ones where I was really behind Donald Trump, and he's fantastic, and he's going to change the world in a really good way, or Nigel Farage, he's the future, or Jacob Rees-Mogg, you haven't even heard of him, he's the future. It just happens. We change as we get older and more and wiser.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Well, wise as serpents, gentle as doves. That's the idea.
Yes.
Aaron, thank you. Thanks to you. And thank you to your even nicer brother, because obviously he's... you've more than vindicated my decision to say yes to your sweet request. So thank you very much. And I hope the book does really well. And I look forward to reading it. And by the way, thank you for, I mean, those guys that you're dealing with every day in that system, I'm sure it does help them that you're there rather than some apparatchik of the security state, you know? So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Well, that's it. I'm gonna say, I suppose I meant to say, thank you, everyone who's watched this and listens to me and supports me. I really appreciate it. Go to my website, which is jamesdellingpole.co.uk, and you can find all sorts of exciting things. And do continue to buy me coffees. I like that as well. And support my sponsors. And thank you again for being a listener. And thank you, Aaron Smith, very much.
Thank you.
There is now a new, better way of supporting me. If you want to, you can now subscribe direct at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. It's now got new features where you can subscribe directly to me. You get access to all my old archive material. You get my podcasts as they come out. And you can comment on the podcast and you can communicate with me probably more directly than you can elsewhere. I think it's probably the best way forward. Also, it obviates the risk of my being suddenly randomly closed down by some of these other websites. I mean, they're not our friends. So if you want to support me direct, go to jamesdellingpole.co.uk and sign up there. Without your support, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. So thank you.
Support ridiculously honest, no holds barred, independent truth seeking at jamesdellingpole.co.uk. The Delling Pod is produced by Wolfish Limited. Guests are very kindly booked by the lovely Venetia. The show is edited by Andrew Warwick, with animation by Warwick A.